for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At his State of the Union address last week, President Obama said he would work with Congress to end the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. Earlier this week, the administration released its budget for the Department of Defense and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the Pentagon issued its quadrennial defense review. Joining me in the studio to talk about the state of the American military, Washington Post Pentagon correspondent Greg Jaffe. Good morning to you, Greg.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Jim Thomas with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
The Lexington Institute's Daniel Gouray. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. And Nathaniel Fick of the Center for a New American Security, our fourth guest. Good morning.
Hi, Diane.
It's good to have you all here and to welcome our callers, our emailers, our members on Facebook and Twitter. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Greg Jaffe, what can you tell us about the new offensive the U.S. is planning in Afghanistan?
Well, the main focus of this offensive is on a central Helmand province, which is in southern Afghanistan, and in particular a town called Marja that actually was helped, that the USAID helped build years and years ago. Putting in canals and making it kind of one of the most fertile places in Afghanistan. It's also one of the largest producing areas of poppy. So that's become a big focus for the U.S. military to take that out because they believe that that's a big part of the financing that the Taliban receive. And if they can control this area, essentially sit on this fertile area that's been a center of poppy production, they can really take a lot of the fuel, they believe, out of the sort of the Taliban's financing.
Why would the U.S. announce this in advance?
Well, it's really a focus of the change strategy. I mean, the focus here, as General McChrystal has said a bazillion times at this point, is on protecting the people, not killing the enemy. So what they're doing by announcing it is they're saying to the enemy, hey, look, we're coming into this city. We don't want to fight you block to block to block because it's going to cause civilian casualties. We want you to leave. And so really by telegraphing it, they're saying, look, you're dead if you stay, so leave. Go out into the hinterlands where you're not going to, where you're going to have less influence, where we're not going to have to fight among the people, we're not going to have to kill civilians. So that's the thought here. And on the other side, it does put troops at more risk. I think you're right to suggest that. I mean, Marines, the fact that the enemy knows Marines are coming, knows about when they're coming, has allowed them to prepare defenses, to lay IEDs for those who stay. So it could result in more U.S. casualties.
Greg Jaffe, the Washington Post, turning to you, Jim Thomas. What do you think of this announcement that they're coming?
Well, I think Greg put his finger on it, which is really, this reflects the new strategy that General McChrystal has adopted in terms of focusing on population-centered protection. And I think by announcing that they're coming, you would anticipate that the Taliban and associated forces will be exiting from the area. But at the same time, this provides the opportunity for consolidating those positions.
Jim Thomas, the studies for the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. I wonder, Daniel Gouray, exiting or creating a greater risk for U.S. troops by announcing this strategy beforehand?
To some extent, it's going to be both. But remember also that there's a number of different audiences here. Greg rightly said that one of them is the Taliban. You'd like to get those who aren't really willing to die to leave the field, so you know who your real enemies are. As Jim pointed out, another body of people you worry about are the civilians in that area, and you want to make sure that they're taking cover. It is also important in some respects to let the American people know that the commitment that was recently made for the surge in oil is sort of working. And fourthly, in a sense, it's a left-hand, right-hand question. We're focusing now on the left-hand, which is this kind of conventional operation, protect the population. There's the other side, which we are hearing about in the press a lot, and that is an intensified campaign to capture or kill Taliban / Al-Qaeda leaders on both sides of the border, which is terribly significant.
Daniel Gurey of the Lexington Institute. And what about you, Nathaniel Fick? Do you see this as a good cop, bad cop kind of approach to the problem of the Taliban?
Counterinsurgency wars like this one, Diane, have been recognized as the graduate level of warfare. And they're really governed by a series of paradoxes. And in a way, they turn the conventional rules of warfare on their head at the tactical level. And so, for instance, the more you try to protect your force, the less secure you may actually be. The more people you kill, even the more enemy fighters you kill, the less progress you make. And so I think that announcing this campaign is a recognition by General McChrystal and by the entire command in Afghanistan that that's well understood. And as Greg said at the outset, this is an opportunity for the Taliban to move out of the populated areas and for this area to be secured, for the insurgency to be denied this fertile poppy-growing area without, hopefully, killing Afghans and retarding our progress.
I know that you served as a Marine Corps infantry officer. You led a reconnaissance unit during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Are U.S. spy agencies doing a better job there in Afghanistan than previously?
Well, tactical intelligence in Afghanistan has come under some public criticism recently, maybe most notably by the commander of U.S. intelligence operations in Afghanistan, Major General Flynn, who published a piece earlier this year very publicly criticizing the way intelligence operations are conducted. And I think that was a recognition on his part that intelligence really drives operations in wars like this one. And given the broader political context of this war, the president and General McChrystal and the rest of the team have about a year to really demonstrate progress. And changing the perceived trajectory and momentum of the war in Afghanistan is going to require better intelligence. And so going public with these criticisms is an attempt to kickstart those reforms.
Nathaniel Fick of the Center for a New American Security. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Every 4 years, Congress requires the Secretary of Defense to conduct what's called a quadrennial defense review. Tell us about that, Jim Thomas, what it is, what it's supposed to assess.
Well, last week, or earlier this week, Secretary Gates submitted the fourth quadrennial defense review report. This is mandated by Congress. Every 4 years, the Department of Defense is asked to undertake a comprehensive look at its strategy, its force structure, its modernization programs. It's an across-the-board look. It really touches on almost every facet of the Department of Defense. In the report that was issued earlier this week by Secretary Gates, he really stressed the theme of rebalancing investments and activities, particularly towards winning the wars that we're in today. He highlighted not only the need to focus on increasing particularly enablers for special operations forces, but also special aircraft, both unmanned reconnaissance aircraft such as Predator and Reaper UAVs, as well as rotary wing assets, MH-47 helicopters for transporting troops in places like Afghanistan where the terrain really demands special mobility assets. At the same time, he also noted the need for balancing the near-term risks that we face with also some longer-term considerations.
Daniel Gray, how do you feel about this so-called QDR?
One Washington insider said, you know, if you're in the Pentagon and you do something really bad, they sentence you to have to write a QDR. Of the four, this is by all accounts the best. I've read it through carefully. It is thoughtful. It is in some ways balanced. It really has the virtue of saying, you know, we're in wars right now, and we better spend a lot of time thinking about that. It's also, frankly, irrelevant.
How so?
Well, because it maintains 99% of the existing force posture, almost all the current weapons programs. In fact, for the long term, as Jim was saying, it even wants to do some other and additional things. It is fiscally unsustainable. We just had a budget of over $700 billion when you count it. It's rising. The defense budget is rising at a time when we know that down the road in a year or two, there's going to be a crash. And one more thing. What does really disturb me about this document is it makes a major shift in kind of strategic orientation away from what they call the two-war strategy towards an idea that complex involved operations will be doing a whole bunch of different things. But when you kind of parse it out, it's doing everything, or it's promising that we're going to have the capability to do everything. It's really expanding our mission set, thereby expanding the costs of this military, inevitably. And when the crash comes, it's going to be even harder.
Daniel Gray, he's vice president of the Lexington Institute, and we're going to take just a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones with your comments, questions. Stay with us. Welcome back as we invite our guest to offer an assessment of the U.S. military as it currently stands. And, of course, we will get to the issue of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which I gather is on many, many minds. But first, here's an email from Arthur, who's in Arlington, Virginia, who says, I realize your guests don't have a crystal ball. I'm wondering what they believe the future holds for traditional warfare. That is, uniformed armies fighting each other, ending by a ceremony of surrender. What do you think, Daniel Gray?
Oh, I think traditional war is very much going to be with us forever. In fact, I've written extensively on the idea that this notion that warfare is fundamentally changed is really wrong. And we are dealing with currently the offshoots of a very peculiar constellation of social forces, ideological forces, and even some economic forces in a narrow part of the world. And that when you look elsewhere, Eastern Europe, Northeast Asia, and elsewhere, you're likely to see conventional war, maybe not like World War II, but conventional war very much with us.
Nate, how do you see it?
I agree with that. I think even if you look all the way back to Henry Kissinger writing about nuclear doctrine in the 1950s, this new revolution in how wars were going to be fought, he acknowledged, and strategists since have acknowledged, that even nuclear conflict starts with a conventional war, typically, and then escalates from there. So it's true that U.S. dominance in the Gulf War drove our adversaries to the poles, to the low end of the spectrum and to the high end of the spectrum. And so I think it's unlikely that adversaries will try to fight the United States conventionally in the near future, but traditional conventional war will very much be with us.
Jim Thomas.
I might take a slightly different view, and that is I think we really need to differentiate between the character of war and the nature of war. I think the nature of war really is enduring, and all the way you can look back to Thucydides and the Peloponnesian Wars to the present, the reasons people go to war don't vary all that much. The character of war, I think, is changing dramatically, and I don't think it's only in the realm of irregular warfare and counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations. I also think that it's going to be the case at the high end. You're going to not have clean starts to wars as we've seen in the past. You already see that today in terms of cyber operations where network attacks are ongoing. You have the similar dynamics in terms of thinking about space warfare. At the same time, I also don't think in the future you're necessarily going to see surrender signing ceremonies on the USS Missouri as you did at the end of World War II.
Greg Jaffe.
I mean, it's interesting when you talk to people in the Pentagon about this, the wars that they like to talk about and they think offer glimpses of the future aren't Iraq and Afghanistan. They talk about the Israeli incursion into Lebanon in 2006, in which the Israelis fought a Hezbollah foe that had a lot of weapons and looked a little bit like a conventional army. They tried to hold ground. They had, you know, they had anti-tank weapons. They had some missiles and took out an Israeli ship. They talk about the Russian-Georgian conflict in which you had a little bit of an element of cyber. You had conventional forces that kind of looked, you know, like the one your caller was referring to, and unconventional forces. So that's what they talk about in the future. I'm a little skeptical that my colleague suggested that someone will take the U.S. on conventionally. And I think part of this, too, is the U.S. defense industry, you know, has a lot invested in big weapon systems that you have for conventional that you need for conventional wars. So they have a fighting interest in keeping that threat alive.
So there's going to be a big fight on some of these military weapons as the president's budget is debated, Greg.
Well, this budget, despite the QDR, and Jim Thomas wrote a previous one that had very similar sentiments to the current one about the sort of the changing nature of the threat. You really aren't seeing big budget cuts this time. Everybody sort of gets what they want here. Now, it may be, and I've been hearing this for years, that, you know, the budget's going to get tighter. We can't sustain these kind of deficits. Hard choices are going to come. But people always say that they're going to come, and they never seem to come.
Jim Thomas, does the president's defense budget focus too much on Afghanistan and Iran?
I think that's really a false choice. It's really the president and the secretary of defense have put emphasis on winning the wars that we're in, and undoubtedly that should be the priority. But I think what's really missing in the discussion is not a trade between future conflicts, cyber warfare, space warfare, other types of asymmetric conflicts that you can imagine, whether they look like Russia and Georgia or they look like Hezbollah in 2006. The real issue here is I think that there is this incredible legacy force that really is optimized for Operation Desert Storm in 1991. And it frankly is not relevant to either the wars we're in or really the wars that we may face in the future. And that really, I think, is what's unfortunate in both in the president's budget as well as in the QDR, is that to a large extent, those programs really have not been touched.
Nathan.
I think the watchword of this QDR really is balance. And as has been said, there's a focus, quite rightly, on winning the wars we're in, but at the same time, a recognition that we don't have the luxury of one future. And we as a country can't possibly foresee the whole range of contingencies that we may have to face. And so there's a certain amount of flexibility that has to be built into the system. Now, I agree entirely that many hard questions remain to be answered, and I think there's some real fights ahead. One to watch might be whether the next Air Force bomber is a manned or unmanned aircraft.
What do you think about that, Daniel Gouret?
Well, you know, that goes back to the larger issue here, which is what do you want a bomber for? If you want it for things like Afghanistan and Iraq, it turns out the B-1, B-52s do superbly well, and they're planned to be with the force for a long time. If you're talking about challenging a high-intensity environment, an air defense environment, now you're talking about fighting a near peer, let me call it that. That's not even Iran. That's got to be somebody even bigger, and we can speculate who that is. If you're going to be fighting that kind of person, back to the point, you're now in a real war. It's conventional warfare at the high end. Whether you're landing forces on an enemy beach in East Asia or not, it's still a big conventional war.
Greg Jaffe, what about the fight that's coming on the F-22?
I think that, you know, that fight is largely over and the Secretary won. That program is going to stop where it is, and it's going to be they've decided a small niche capability. I mean, I think the Secretary's betting that we're not going to be in a big conventional war soon. So you've got a small number of F-22s. Their primary mission is not going to be fighting other fighter jets because there aren't other fighter jets out there for them to fight. Their primary mission is going to be escorting B-2 bombers, sort of stealth bombers, into enemy territory. You see them being used ideally in a place like Iran. You know, if you were wanting to knock down the Iranian defenses and take out a Iranian nuclear facility, the F-22 is critical for that sort of mission. It's critical in a place like North Korea if you wanted to take something out like that. Beyond that, it doesn't have a lot of applicability, and you're not going to see it used in Iraq, Afghanistan, any of those sorts of wars.
But Daniel Gouray, you were talking about Congress's investment in these kinds of weapons all around the country. Is Congress going to give up that easily on those particular weapon systems within their own jurisdictions?
They don't have a good track record of going quietly into the night. And for example, two systems that were specifically mentioned by the Secretary when he introduced the budget that he wants to cancel and where Congress has been fighting back are the C-17, the large jet transport, and what they call the alternative engine, a second designed engine for the F-35 fighter. They've tried to cut both of those, and Congress has put money, lots of money, back in. So we'll see whether this time the Secretary can carry the day.
All right. Let's turn to an issue I think many of our listeners are concerned about. Greg Jaffe, why is the military now considering ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
And I think it's largely because the president is driving it as an issue. I think times have changed as well. I mean, it's interesting as you talk to people, and I'm oversimplifying here, but the generals are a lot more concerned about this than the sergeants and the majors and the captains that I talk to. And I just think it's in part a sort of a generational divide here. I find the military interesting. It's a very conservative institution in some ways, but it also tends to be, at least to me, sort of surprisingly libertarian. You know, as long as you do your job, people tend not to care too much what you do in your private time. And so I tend to think for a lot of the concern that you hear among senior folks that there is a generational divide here. And I'm more inclined to listen to the people who joined the military kind of after 1990, 1995, than the people who joined it in the 70s and 80s.
And Nathaniel, even Colin Powell, who helped establish Don't Ask, Don't Tell, now says it's time to do away with it. What's your thinking?
I think that's a great indicator of just how much times have changed. And it's been almost a full generation since Don't Ask, Don't Tell was initiated in the early 1990s. And I agree with Greg. I think there's a generational divide here. I feel strongly that the military, as an organization that trades in risk, should be lower C conservative, and it can't be a social experiment for the country. But that said, Don't Ask, Don't Tell strikes me as a relatively young veteran of these wars as a morally untenable position. And as a policy that just doesn't help us with the overarching goal of winning the wars we're in. We have a Secretary of Defense right now who is the strongest and maybe the most respected ever. a very strong and well-respected chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and a president who was savvy enough not to take this on in his first year, but rather to demonstrate his commitment to properly resourcing the war in Afghanistan. And now he's going to take it on. And I think the time is ripe. And I think if you were to survey troops in the ranks who fought in Iraq and in Afghanistan, you would see them reflecting American society and reflecting the reality that gays and lesbians are much more integrated. They are in a different place socially than they were in the early 1990s. And it's time to change this policy.
Jim Thomas.
I agree with Greg and Nate on this. I think it really is about generational change. I think the real key in our military is going to be the standards of conduct that we hold people to, whether they're straight or gay, frankly. And I think that that's really the key. It's what you're doing on the job. It's your performance. It's how you comport yourself, regardless of your orientation.
Daniel Goray.
While I agree with everything that's been said, it does strike me that this is not the most felicitous time to be putting this extra issue on the backs of the military, the secretary, the chairman, and the like. Because there are structural issues. They want to do a study. There are questions about how one treats partners under the family side of caring for our military. And so it's just, it's another burden. One would, whereas back to the last time this was tried, you know, it was really in peacetime and we were looking for a economic and a social, if you will, peace dividend. Now, in the midst of war, struggling to get everything from nuclear arms control to predator routes in Afghanistan right, this is it's an unfortunate time, I guess is what I would say. But the issue itself is righteous.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. An unfortunate time, Greg Jaffe.
You know, I think it is a tougher time. And I did talk to one brigade commander who made an interesting point to me. He said, you know, if you ask the majority of my soldiers whether they think homosexuality is immoral or not, he thought that among his troops, and he's an infantry brigade commander, that more of them would say that they thought it was immoral than the average population. And he thought that that might present a problem for him and thought that the comparison to civil rights integration and integrating African Americans didn't necessarily apply because nobody thought, you know, you couldn't blame some, you couldn't, nobody thought being African American was immoral. And so he thought it could be a trickier issue for him to manage as a commander. And I thought that was an interesting point. Whether it bears out or not, I don't know. That said, I think he did think it was manageable, but it was one more thing on his plate as a commander, and he's got a lot on his plate.
But how do you think Colin Powell's statement helps commanders move toward that decision?
I think Powell's statement matters a lot. I think Admiral Mullen's statement as the, you know, the senior military officer in our military matters a whole lot. And I think it matters a lot what sort of how brigade commanders, battalion commanders, company commanders, what message they send to their troops. That probably matters more than anything. And sergeants, you know, what the first sergeant says and how he conducts himself. That's the most important thing, probably.
What about the timing, Nathaniel?
I think you can't always pick your fights. And this was coming to a head. It was a campaign promise of the president. He managed to put it off for a year. And in a way, you could say we've managed to punt on this for 17 years. There's never going to be a perfect time. And while I certainly admit that it imposes an administrative and bureaucratic burden in working through the issues, at the same time, you could say that it takes a burden off the military by ending a policy of dismissal of people in critical jobs, people who have critical language skills. So I think there are benefits in addition to the burdens.
You're referring to a gay man who was removed from the military who spoke Arabic.
Right. I think there are many of those cases, actually, dozens every year.
Daniel, what about the fact that, you know, there's never a perfect time?
Absolutely. And I wasn't looking for perfection in all this. We are now kind of with the clock ticking on the surge in Afghanistan. So, you know, this may be, I guess my emphasis would be, a particularly unfortunate time. That having been said, It was largely a political decision. It was not driven by any real concern within the military. One way or another, they were losing people. Was this disastrous? No, or they would have spoken up. So this is a political decision. The military will do the best they can, and they'll do great in the end, as they did with desegregation and bringing women in. My point is simply, there are better and worse times, not perfect times, and this was a worse time.
Is it also because recruitment, though it has been met this year, that recruitment for the future could be damaged if you excluded gays?
I think that's a marginal issue, Diane. I think the economy, for instance, or the broader perception of what military life means in a time of war matter much more. The one place it may actually affect recruitment and have an outsized effect on society is the issue of ROTC on college campuses. Mm. And right now, ROTC programs are excluded from many campuses because Don't Ask, Don't Tell is considered a discriminatory hiring practice. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether that is, in fact, why they're excluded or whether that's a fig leaf that some schools are using.
Nathaniel Fick, the Center for a New American Security. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your email and your phone calls. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
How the creation of the atom bomb led to greater power for the president. Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Gary Wills explains why secrecy surrounding the Manhattan Project resulted in unprecedented powers for modern U.S. presidents. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about the current state of the military, as well as very much Don't Ask, Don't Tell, let's go first to Bloomington, Indiana. Good morning, Farish. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to thank your panel for all agreeing that this is an issue of morality and righteousness. But one of your guests strayed very close to a Republican talking point, which is that the timing is bad because we're in a state of war. Well, all of your guests have told us that we're in a new state of war, a changing time, and that we're looking at an indefinite period of war. We might be in Afghanistan and in these new conflicts that are so unlike past wars for decades to come. And one cannot argue with intellectual honesty that we should wait for a better time at the same time that they claim that we have to adapt to this new state of never-ending, undefinable war.
All right, Ferris, thanks for your call. Daniel.
I don't buy the second half of that argument, which is it's a new state of perpetual war, da-da-da-da-da. I think, literally, this is sort of a two-year window, which I think is less felicitous than at other times. Whether it's a Republican point, I don't know, but it's mine. Having said that, is it impossible to do? No. Were there been better times to do it? Yes. Can this be worked through very successfully? Sure.
Greg Jaffe, what do you think?
I mean, one of the interesting things that I find about Iraq and Afghanistan and how it's changed the military officers and soldiers and Marines tend to see things much less in black and white terms than they used to. I mean, when you're negotiating with a tribal sheikh who was fighting your guys, you know, 2 months ago, and all of a sudden you're paying his guys to essentially not fight you anymore, and you realize that that's better than trying to destroy him. You know, there's a certain intellectual flexibility to the force that didn't exist before, a willingness to compromise, an understanding that the world out there is very different from America. And in some ways, I think that could help make this transition easier,
right.
Although that may be a stretch.
To San Antonio, Texas. Hi there, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you. My question was regarding the first discussion, and if the strategy is open and public, and that creates a larger defense. And we said that we wanted to keep the population safe and kill the Taliban. Whether or not that leaves wiggle room for a larger death toll of the general population in Afghanistan.
Jim Thomas.
Well, I think by announcing before going in to start a new campaign, what the intent is, I think there's every possibility that the Taliban forces actually will withdraw themselves before the fight.
Why would they?
Well, I think it's open to question, but they're going to face a superior force, and their mode of operations is to withdraw and normally fight another day.
But why wouldn't they take hostages, for example, among civilians, or plant bombs in civilian locales to further confuse American forces as they go in?
Well, I think those will always be risks, but I think in terms of at the operational level and calling for a campaign, I think what you're really trying to do is the best way to win a battle is the one you don't fight. And here, I think if you can go and you can establish security in those areas and push the Taliban out, that may be a viable strategy.
Daniel Gouray, how likely is it that the Taliban will leave in the face of that forewarning?
We're not talking about a monolithic Taliban. It's an important notion and one that really drives the current strategy. And the target, if you will, aside from the real civilian population, are those groups, the tribes and the tribal elders, who are not really totally on with Al-Qaeda or rather with the Taliban, or may only be reluctantly participating because the Taliban is the only force in town, if you will. You're telling them that they're going to have the option of backing out or of telling their young warriors, listen, Americans are coming. The bad Taliban is going to be booking for the hills. And if you can just hold your water, you'll be safe. You'll keep us safe. So this has a, if you will, what they call an information operation component that may be very, very clever and very successful.
Nathaniel, what's stopping the Taliban from simply moving on then to the next village and the whole thing becomes circular?
Well, the short answer, an honest answer, I think, for any of us is we don't know,
right,
because we're not privy to the information.
Right.
But I think if you tease this out, and you can assume that while one operation is being telegraphed, there are many simultaneous operations that are not being telegraphed. And so I would think that there are, say, special operations forces waiting along these known rat lines where the Taliban might be fleeing in advance of this offensive, ready to sweep them up. I also suspect that there's been long-term persistence American presence in areas around Marja where the Marines have been providing social services, have been providing basic protection to the population in sort of an inkblot strategy of creating one area of success and then building out from that area. And word gets out among the people People in one village look two or three villages down the valley, and they see relative security. They see irrigation projects being redeveloped. They see bridges. They see cold storage, and they want a piece of that.
All right, to Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi there, Walt.
Good morning.
Morning.
Two quick comments on the don't ask, don't tell topic.
Sure.
I'm a senior NCO. I've been in the Army for 22 years this summer. I have worked for and with, and I have supervised gay and lesbian soldiers for almost my entire career, and never once have I had a single issue regarding anybody's sexual orientation. My people have always been professional. They do their jobs. Most of the people in my unit were aware of the fact that we had gay and lesbian soldiers. It just simply wasn't an issue.
And just to further that comment, here's a message on Facebook from Matthew, who says, there was no time in my duration in the Air Force in which I did not know someone who was gay. They're already in the military doing a hell of a job. It's about time America repaid these patriots by letting them serve openly. Nathaniel.
I really appreciate that comment on the phone from the senior NCO, because NCOs are the backbone of the U.S. military, and the success or failure of any policy depends on, I think, a couple of things: the command climate set by the commanders, and then the spirit of the implementation and the example set by the NCOs. And I will just harken back to a comment Jim made earlier, that the real the proof here is going to be the implementation of the UCMJ. And there is a military code of justice that governs conduct in the military, and paramount in the UCMJ is the preservation of good order and discipline. That is, no policy in the military can undermine its effectiveness as a fighting force. And so inappropriate relationships, whether gay or straight, have no place in a military unit. And so under the UCMJ, they should be treated the same. And if they undermine good order and discipline, then they have to be dealt with.
So, Greg Jaffe, having heard from the Secretary of Defense, having heard from Admiral Mullen, from Colin Powell and others, what's the next step?
Well, I think the military is going to look at this for a year. They've appointed a general and a DOD civil, a Department of Defense civilian, to look at how what needs to happen kind of before the law can be changed, how a new policy might be implemented. So I think we're not looking at this changing, I don't think, in the next couple of months. I think we're looking at it changing over the course of the next couple of years.
But it's interesting what happens in the meantime, Jim Thomas.
Well, I think we're probably in a bit of a no man's land in the interim. However, I do have to say, I think that the administration and DOD are handling this far better than it was handled in 1993. And I think that to a large extent, the conditions have been set so that I think that you will, in fact, have a smooth transition towards a new policy.
All right. To Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You touched a little bit earlier on our problem with the deficit and our really growing problem. And one thing I wanted to ask about was some of our footprints around the world. My reading of history, whether it's the British Empire down to Rome, they fell apart from overexpansion and basically thinking they needed to rule the world. We have all these bases around the world. We have some in Europe and like Japan. There's some places I understand you need to have them, but it seems like we could get rid of a lot of these. And whenever the argument comes up as for having them, it's always like, well, we need to have them in case we need to go and take care of a problem in the world. And I think it's going to come to a point where we need to have a sea change from that whole idea that we need to be the policeman of the world. And the other thing is, like, we know the problem with Afghanistan we have now is, I'm wondering if we took 25% of that military budget and we spent it on things like we should have with Afghanistan after the Russians got out of there, if we wouldn't have a much greater return on our, less terrorism and everything, than having this big footprint all over the world, and we're going to spend ourselves into oblivion. I think the Tea Partiers need to pick that up.
All right. Thanks for calling. Nathaniel.
I would only say that Secretary Rumsfeld initiated a real realignment of U.S. bases overseas to better reflect the reality of a changing world with the balance of power and focus of so many issues shifting from Europe to Asia. So right now, the U.S. has a smaller percentage of its forces permanently based overseas than it did for the past several decades. And just to push back on one comment the caller made, there may be a popular perception that these bases exist solely to serve American ends. But if you travel through Asia, or you travel through parts of Europe, and you talk to people, you see that the visible American presence, the visible security guarantee that comes with the presence of these forces is hugely, hugely reassuring and is actually one of the major underpinnings of stability in large swaths of the world.
Here's an email following up on that from Glenn in Frankfort, Kentucky. Could you please ask, what's the justification for spending as much on defense as the entire rest of the world combined? Doesn't that indicate massive waste and inefficiency? Daniel Gouray.
If you want the best military in the world, one that can go essentially anywhere you want it to go on a moment's notice, can put 10,000 people and an aircraft carrier into Haiti virtually overnight, and you want those people to be well paid, well fed, their families to be taken care of, it costs. We have more lawyers in the military than a half a dozen European allies have infantrymen. That's a choice we are making. You could have a cheaper army, a military, not just smaller, but cheaper. You could train them less. You could give them poorer equipment. You could...
Why are there so many lawyers in the military?
Why are there so many lawyers in American society? It's exactly the same problem. Every time you plan a mission, every time you decide you want to drop a bomb, a lawyer gets involved.
Interesting. Greg Jaffe, do you want to comment?
Well, I was just going to say, lawyers turn out to be immensely helpful when you're fighting counterinsurgency wars, in part because you're doing a lot of contracting. You're trying to build things. You're doing a lot of governance. It's interesting. General Petraeus, when he was in Iraq, among the most important people on his staff were lawyers. I mean, you're trying to set up a new justice system in a place like Iraq and Afghanistan. You're wrestling with detention policy. Who do you hold? How long do you hold them? In a funny way, lawyers become almost as important as sort of maneuver commanders in these wars.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Marie. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I have a question. I heard a report on Worldling TV from a Christian Science Monitor journalist that we have prisons in Afghanistan, okay? There's one that's open to the Red Cross and all, but there are other ones that are secret. Special operation forces go in there, and they're still torturing. And, you know, I just would like to know what your guest think about this.
Nathaniel.
There are certainly are prisons in Afghanistan, some acknowledged and some not. I know that the stated policy of the U.S. government now is that we do not torture, a position we should have held from the outset and always should maintain. I don't think we can undermine our own ideals when we claim that we're fighting to protect them. So to my knowledge, there is not torture and abuse happening on a wide scale in these places. And I would just say that more transparency, better oversight, better accountability, these things are essential because the misperception that the U.S. is continuing some of these misbegotten practices really undermines our information operations and undermines our narrative overseas.
Greg Jaffe, if you heard the same reports as our caller.
There certainly are prisons that we're not acknowledging, and there have been claims of torture. But Nate's exactly right that, you know, the stated policy of the U.S. government is that you use the interrogation practices in the Army Field Manual, and that you don't push further than that. So if it's happening, I mean, it should be punished, and it should be and those individuals should be disciplined in some fashion.
Daniel Gouret.
A writer once called this kind of conflict war in the shadows. And I think one of the insidious features, which is now infecting the Obama administration, is the conduct of sort of clandestine classified operations. I mean, as the president said, the State of the Union, he's been firing hellfires and killing more people on the borders than his predecessor, or this year than the predecessor did the year before. Yeah, and under what authority, with what legal, you know, what lawyer was there and all the rest. There's a lot going on that we know very little about. There are reasons for us not knowing about it. But in that environment, it's real easy to slip over the line into illegal detention, perhaps even torture.
Last word, Jim Thomas.
Secretary Gates has been clear, and the QDR highlighted this earlier this week on adhering to the standards in the Geneva Conventions, and as Greg pointed out, the Army Field Manual for interrogations. Fighting these wars in the shadows is always going to have this level of ambiguity, and keeping our reputation as we move forward as a power is going to be critical.
Jim Thomas, Daniel Gouret, Nathaniel Fick, and Greg Jaffe, thank you all so much. Good to talk with you. Some of this leaves me uneasy, as I'm sure it does many of our listeners. And thanks to all of you for listening this morning. I'm Diane Rehm.